From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Biden is in Cleveland today to pitch what the White House calls his American Jobs Plan, also known as the Infrastructure Plan, just as Republicans in Washington are out with their latest counteroffer aimed at limiting the scope of that sweeping proposal. Senate Republicans have upped their top-line numbers substantially, but the two sides remain more than $700 billion apart. Bharat Ramamurthy is Deputy Director of the White House National Economic Council. Welcome.
Thank you.
So the president in Cleveland, which we know is part of the manufacturing Rust Belt, what message is he getting across?
Well, I think the president wants to do two things in the speech today. Number one, he wants to talk a little bit about how far we've come in just the first few months. When he came to office, independent experts were projecting something like 3% or 4% economic growth this year. Now those projections have gone up to 6% or even 7% in some cases. And so now the question is, how do we build on this progress by making the kinds of big generational investments in roads and bridges and broadband to build on this momentum?
Okay, a couple things. I am looking at the unemployment rate in Cleveland. It peaked in April 2020 at 21.4%. It's now a little over 5%. But as you know, the most recent jobs report was so disappointing, 266,000 jobs instead of the million hoped for. The unemployment is still, you know, very high, over 6%. And, you know, Republicans are saying that some of the jobless benefits, for instance, the COVID payments, are what is keeping people staying home, keeping people from getting jobs. You have the Senator Roger Marshall of Kansas. He held that news conference with poster boards showing how the price had gone up on everything and how because of the extended enhanced weekly benefits in the rescue package, people in his meat industry in his area can't get people to come back to work because they're getting paid by the government. Respond to that.
Sure. So I think, first of all, it's important to look at longer-term trends when it comes to jobs. We are averaging 500,000 new jobs per month. That's over 1.5 million new jobs in the first 3 months of his presidency. Literally no other president in history has accomplished that rate of job growth in their first 3 months. So we think that the president's economic strategy is working. As for the unemployment benefits, number one, the president has made clear he's not going to turn his back on people who have become unemployed through no fault of their own and need a few hundred bucks a week in order to pay the groceries and pay the rent. And at the same time, he's also made clear that the rules of the unemployment program are that if you are offered a suitable job at a wage that is comparable to what you used to get paid before you were unemployed, you have to take that job or you will lose your benefits.
What about the cost of things? Inflation. It was up to an annual rate of 4.2% in April. I mentioned Senator Marshall and other Republicans eager to point this out with poster boards showing milk and gas and bread and other things costing much more. It's a 13-year high.
Well, I think that, number one, we saw a drop in the price of many things as we entered the pandemic early last year, and there's going to be a natural rise in some of the costs of these things as we start to emerge at the other side. It's a sign that the economy is healthy. We expect there to be these kinds of short-term dislocations, but over the long term, we expect robust economic growth. We expect wages to keep rising, and we expect inflation to be temporary and manageable.
Yeah, and we know that the president, with the help of your office, we're sure, the White House National Economic Council, lopped off $550 billion from his original proposal this week. He's still calling, though, for $1.7 trillion of spending. Republicans are howling. They did add money in their most recent proposal for roads, bridges, water, rail, airports. They still say, though, they don't want things that are not traditionally considered infrastructure, things like childcare. We know the Biden administration feels that building families is a part of the country's infrastructure. And the Republicans are also saying they don't, they're rejecting your administration's plan to pay for some of this, including increasing the corporate tax rate up to 28%, closer to where it used to be, and increasing the top federal income tax rate to nearly 40% for those making more than $400,000 a year. So with Republicans saying they don't like what you're planning to spend the money on and they don't like the way you're getting the money, do you think there's going to be a deal?
Well, we just received a counteroffer. We are still reviewing that. We appreciate the back and forth that we're having. I would just say when it comes to the types of investments that the president wants to make, we are behind in fixing our roads and bridges. It's going to take federal investment to catch up in those areas. And as for how we pay for all of this, the president's plan would simply ask corporations who benefit from all of these infrastructure investments to pay their fair share. We think that that's a completely reasonable approach and one that we hope that Republicans will end up being open to.
Bharat Ramamurthy, Deputy Director of the White House National Economic Council, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The city of San Jose woke up yesterday ready to celebrate. After years of planning, the council had approved just hours before daybreak the expansion of Google's mega campus, which is expected to bring with it the kind of economic prosperity the city hasn't experienced in decades. But that celebration was eclipsed by a mass shooting. Here's California Governor Gavin Newsom.
There's a numbness I imagine some of us are feeling about this, because there's a sameness to this. You know, anywhere USA, it just feels like this happens over and over and over again. Rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat.
9 people were killed. The shooter killed himself on scene. San Jose now has the distinction as the 15th city in America to experience a mass shooting this year. Audity Bunlamudi lives just a few blocks away from where these shootings happened, a rail yard just outside of downtown San Jose. She's a reporter for KQED.
I got the call at 7:30 in the morning that there was a mass shooting that was happening. I was getting ready to work on further coverage of the Google deal when I started seeing reports of the shooting that the police had sanctioned off that area. And then I headed over there.
Bunlamudi raced to the news conferences to gather more information. San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo spoke about the victims, some of whom were transit employees at the Valley Transportation Authority.
These are the women and men who support our community through this pandemic. They showed up at work every day as essential workers, despite risk to their own health. And they did it because they understood their mission, their commitment to public service. We owe them and their families so much.
And as the names of the victims were released, people like San Jose City Council member Raul Perales began to fear the worst.
I woke up to the news of an active shooter here at the VTA lot. And, you know, personally, I have a friend that I know works at VTA. So that immediately my thoughts went, you know, to his whereabouts. And that's actually why I'm here as well today.
He later learned his friend was indeed one of the victims. Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna, who represents a part of San Jose, shared with PBS NewsHour the deep hurt and anger the community feels.
You know, I've been in Congress for 5 years, and we still have not passed meaningful gun legislation. And people really are frustrated. They want to see action.
The big outstanding question now is why. And we have with us Audity. Audity, what more can you tell us about the gunman who carried out this shooting?
So officials still haven't confirmed his name for me, but we know that he was a VTA employee. And investigators are saying the shooting took place in multiple locations. And yesterday, a bomb-sniffing dog detected explosive material, so they had to step back and send in a bomb squad to clear the area. It could take days to clear that area because it's just so big.
For folks who don't know, can you give us a sense of the Valley Transportation Authority and this area around it?
Yeah, it's not far from downtown San Jose. It's around this area where there's the sheriff's office training center, there's the county main jail, there's the district attorney's office. And it's this area where one of the Bay Area's largest public transportation agencies start their work.
We heard the mayor talk about the victims. What else have you learned about them?
Well, the Office of the Medical Examiner has released the names of the victims and their ages. They range from 29 years old to 63, and they were longtime VTA employees. One was a substation manager, another was a light rail operator. And as we learn more about the victims, we're learning about their mark on our community. The county is offering trauma counseling for people affected by the shooting, and a local nonprofit has set up a fund to support the families of the victims.
The city has really been in a state of emotional whiplash over the past 24 hours, to say the least. What do you want the nation to know about San Jose, the people who live there, and how this is taking a toll on all of you?
The South Bay has been the scene of a few mass shootings in recent years. In 2019, there was the Gilroy Garlic Festival shooting where three people, including a six-year-old boy, was killed. And the year before that, and further up the peninsula, three people were killed and in San Bruno at YouTube's headquarters. San Jose is one of the largest cities in the Bay Area, and it's home to a lot of families who then go to other parts of the Bay to work in Silicon Valley or other industries here. And it's just bizarre and really scary to see this happen in our backyard, especially now as we're just starting to open up and get back to the way things were before the pandemic hit.
That's Audity Bunlamudi. She's a reporter for KQED. Thank you so much for this update.
Thank you.
The fragile ceasefire between Israel and Gaza continues to hold, but tensions between Israelis and Palestinians remains high, with sporadic fights between Jews and Arabs across Israel. The recent 11-day air war was devastating. More than 240 Palestinians and a dozen Israelis died. 300 buildings in Gaza razed. Many people still unwavering in their certainty that their side is blameless. But there are Israelis and Palestinians working together to end the conflict. As one group wrote on its website, "We believe it can be different." That group is Parents Circle Families Forum, and its members have suffered what many can't imagine, losing a loved family member to this conflict. And despite that, or maybe because of it, its members believe that regardless of the Israeli occupation or random acts of terrorism or failed treaties, war, there can be peace. Joining us from Parents Circle, first by Skype, Robbie Damelin, a Jewish Israeli who joined Parents Circle after her son David was killed by a Palestinian sniper in 2002. Robbie, so sorry for your loss.
Thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to spread another message out of this very dark place that has been giving very bad news and doesn't really hear other voices.
Yeah. Well, let's bring in another voice, Bassam Aramin, who grew up in Hebron. He lost his 10-year-old daughter, Abir, in 2007. She was shot and killed by an Israeli soldier. Bassam, so sorry for your loss. I mean, these are unimaginable. And welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much. We born to live, both of us, Israelis and Palestinians and Americans, everyone. So it's a real tragedy when we face it. We start to rethink about our life, why we kill, why we die, how we can exist together.
Yeah. Well, and it's so noble, but I have to start by saying I feel I've spoken to parents groups over the years, the decades of this horrific conflict, have dedicated themselves to the belief that there can be peace. Robbie, start with you. Where do you find that hope?
Well, if there won't be any hope, there certainly will never be any peace, because that's a very important equation. And that's why there's so much violence, because so many people are left without hope. So unless we can find a way to create a reconciliation process, which will be an integral part of any political peace agreement later on, otherwise, all we can expect is another round of violence. You know, I've been thinking about the children who live in Gaza, who will grow up seeing all this death and buildings being broken down and not having a shelter to run to. And I look at the mothers who live in Sderot and Ashkelon and Ashdod, which is on the border of Gaza, and they have shelters to run to, but they may only have 15 seconds to get there. So what are their children going to grow up doing? So we have to work so much harder now. It's not a question of giving up hope. I don't give up hope.
Stay on the Israeli side of the border, Robbie. You know that at the heart of what seems like this intractable conflict is a furious fight over land. And on your side, Israel has become more nationalist. There are more Jews moving into the settlements that we hear about. How do you resolve that?
There cannot ever be peace here unless Israel will end the occupation. It is very clear. We've known it for so many years. And when you look at what is happening internally with all the fighting and the anger, it's in the young. It's in kids of 16 to 20. And it's like somebody released this bottle of hatred. And the settler children are also involved in this battle. These children are absolutely doing things without any punishment. The Palestinian-Israeli kids are also in a very difficult position because they don't live in an equal society. They may have something very similar, but they certainly don't have the same schools as Israeli children. And so why would they not be angry? And please don't for one minute think I've now become a Palestinian. I am an Israeli. I love this country, but I want us to live in a moral country. And I want the Palestinians to have a free state of their own.
Bassem, you were one of those young people. By the age of 12, you were committed to the Palestinian cause. You were arrested at 17. You know, address that rage that you were expressing and that it's being expressed now. Palestinians who want the right of return to the land of Israel. Their families left maybe decades ago when Israel was declared a Jewish state. How would you speak to Palestinians about those demands that Israel says are not going to be met?
When you talk about the refugees to come back to their land, they have the right to return. But there is a difference between right and return. It's a political issue. I am not a politician. But in general, this is the source of the problem. This is the reasons that we lost our kids. Robbie lost David, I lost Abir. Both of them are victims to these circumstances. So we call for a political solution to start a reconciliation process so we can live, both of us, in peace and security and prosperity.
Bassem, how did you come to this? From a kid throwing stones and probably having rage to someone who is in a group with Israelis, even after an Israeli killed your daughter. How did you make that transition?
You know, it's a long process, but it's not a personal thing between this victim, I call him a victim, who killed my daughter at the age of 10, and me personally. It's part of the environment, of the circumstances, the political circumstances. We are people, very sensitive, well-educated, looking for to establish a democratic state, to live as the rest of the world live.
Bassem, I just have to ask you, why would you call the sniper who killed your daughter a victim?
You know, when someone belonged to the most moral army on earth, kills a 10-year-old daughter from a distance of 15 to 20 meters, and he didn't show any empathy, absolutely he's a victim because he thinks he's a hero. For that, when I met him 3.5 years in the court, I said to him, you need to know that you are not a hero. You are not a warrior. Simply, I love my daughter very much. And because I have another 5 kids, I don't want them to grow up as victims to you. So he's a victim
of the whole conflict. Robbie, your son David also killed. And we're reading the very first thing that you said, the first words out of your mouth were, do not take revenge in the name of my son. Where did that conviction come from?
Well, I think you can already hear from the way that I speak that I was born in South Africa. And that had a lot to do with who I became. You know, I was in the anti-apartheid movement. And it was really prophetic of what I was going to be doing with the rest of my life. And I started to travel and to talk in Congress and the House of Lords, even in your parliament. And then they caught the man who killed David. And that's when the real test comes, to see if you really mean what you say. And that's what pushed me to write a letter to the family and to tell them about David and to tell them about the parent circle, that we are 600 families who've all lost an immediate family member, but we work for reconciliation and nonviolence.
So it sounds like both of you are saying, I mean, this is such a complicated issue. You both believe that there should be a political solution, that Israel stopping the occupation of the territories would be the start, and then a move toward a two-state solution, perhaps right of return. I mean, you think these are issues that need to be talked about. But even before that, people have to stop the violence and somehow try to find forgiveness to be able to move to that place. And Bassem, I'm imagining that you have fellow Palestinians who might be enraged at you for saying this.
Absolutely, because we still live under the same occupation, the same difficulties. So I understand them, but I am not in danger. They just need to see some hope. When we say free Palestine, in fact, we say free Israel also. They don't need to be killed. We both will exist on this land as one state or two states or five states. Otherwise, we will share the same land as two big graves. In the end, we need to learn how to live together, give the Palestinians their rights, and the Israelis deserve to live in security.
Robbie, I can only imagine that there's been a lot of anger directed at you as well.
Well, you know, I can't be affected by that. I really don't care because I get talkbacks every time I write something in the newspaper that I should burn in Auschwitz and other things. However, you know, I just wanted to say something about this huge pandemic and how many families have lost loved ones. I just wanted to give a small tip, if I may, and that is write a letter to the person that you couldn't say goodbye to. It will give you a lot of solace.
Hmm. That's Robbie Damelin, a Jewish Israeli whose son was killed by a Palestinian sniper. And we spoke with Bassem Aramin. His 10-year-old daughter was killed by an Israeli soldier. They're both members of Parent Circle. That's an organization of Palestinians and Israelis who've lost loved ones. Bassem, Robbie, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, thank you.
And during this recent chapter of the conflict, Parents Circle has been holding daily Zoom vigils with speakers. It's called the Virtual Peace Square for Dialogue, Reconciliation and Peace. We'll link you to their website at hereandnow.org.
On NPR's Rough Translation,
there's just fewer people that know somebody that's in the military.
After 20 years of war, are civilians and military farther apart than ever?
They were asking me, do you want to hear this? Do you want to know us?
Listen to Homefront, the new season of Rough Translation.
A tiny activist investor won a hard-fought battle against an oil giant this week. Engine Number One, a new activist hedge fund, secured two seats on ExxonMobil's board of directors yesterday, part of a larger push by activists to force oil companies to take climate change more seriously. Let's bring in MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. And Ali, during this meeting yesterday, Engine Number One's Charlie Penner called his fund's campaign a long shot. They were trying to get four seats on Exxon's board, but they got two. How big a deal is this?
And they came close to three out of 12 board seats. This is, I can't explain how big a deal this is. This is monumental. ExxonMobil, the biggest, the oldest, the sort of the stalwart of the energy industry, having two people on the board now who feel that their climate strategy is incorrect. The only reason they got those two seats and almost a third is because they were backed by BlackRock. And BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street are the biggest investors, you know, that people use for their 401ks to buy exchange-traded funds. So these big investment firms, which used to represent sort of moneyed interests and wealthy people, now represent a complete cross-section of America. And those investors want their investments to go in things that are more corporate, you know, that have greater corporate responsibility. So BlackRock and others have been pressuring these boards across America, including Exxon, to take more responsibility. And they back these two directors, which is why they're on the board.
And people might be used to activist investors who buy a lot of stock, so they get to go to the big meetings and they stand in the back and kind of yell out, "You should do this." You know, but this is on the board. And Engine Number One was started last year for this purpose, to challenge Exxon's strategy. What are they critical of? What would they like to see? What might they be pushing?
Well, so, yeah, you're right. A voice on the board is very different than a voice in the back of a room in an annual meeting. So this is a, it almost doesn't feel right to use the word activist. They're now actually on the board. They did start with the idea of getting oil and gas companies like ExxonMobil to be more responsible, to take climate change seriously. Remember, these are companies that had data about the effect of oil on climate and not only denied that data, but sort of misled the public on it. So the chief of engine number one, Charlie Penner, who spoke there, he said, change, even under the best of circumstances, will take work, will take years. The work has to begin now. Basically, they're saying that the CEO of Exxon just isn't moving fast enough. And now there'll be somebody, again, two of 12 members. That's a big deal on the board, at board meetings, agitating for them to say the right thing, do the right thing, and make more aggressive change.
Yeah, two other oil companies also took steps yesterday. A Dutch court ruled Shell has to ramp up its strategy to cut emissions, and Chevron shareholders voted the company must align its climate goals with the Paris Agreement. What's your sense of what's happening here?
I think this is sea change. This is a very, very big deal. We knew that these companies won't change their view on climate change when dealing with such a lucrative business such as oil and gas until the big money started saying they need to. And now that's what's happening. The big money, represented by these major ETF and shareholding asset management firms, are now stepping in and saying, we will back candidates who cause you to do these things. It's a big, big change.
MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi telling us about it. Ali, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Since George Floyd's murder a year ago this week, calls to defund the police rose to a roar in some communities. Ithaca, New York decided to rebuild the police, to rename the Ithaca Police Department something like the Department of Public Safety, with a police chief reporting to a civilian supervisor, armed and unarmed divisions, a promise to police they'll keep their benefits, and this will actually free them to do real police work. Mayor Savante Myrick was behind the proposal. Mayor Myrick, start with how you're demilitarizing your police.
Many communities received over the last decade and a half a bunch of military equipment from the Department of Defense. You know, we've resisted receiving that, but still, police culture has evolved, and this was true here in Ithaca too, to include a very military style, both in our tactics and in our aesthetics, which led us to hear from our citizens that they felt like they were being occupied instead of protected. So small things like the uniforms they wear being camouflaged, even though they're working in an urban environment, and the equipment like our SWAT vehicle being black and looking militaristic, all the way to the actual tactics. We've announced that we'll be no longer serving no-knock warrants using our SWAT team. We've also changing the look of the vehicle, removing all weapons from the vehicle, turning it into a true mobile command center so it can still be used in some circumstances, and changing the way it looks. So painting it white, removing the military vibe, as well as changing the officers' uniforms. We think those are important first steps.
You referred to Ithaca as kind of an urban center. Now, I just have to say, Ithaca, beautiful town. I've lived there. It's not what people would think of as an urban center there in bucolic upstate New York.
Yes.
What do you say to cities who say, well, that's fine for you to do with your truck. You're not having hundreds of people come to your city for riots.
I think all cities should do it. But I think that's up for to each community to decide for themselves. I think you will be able to keep your community safer when the public safety department is the one that sets a tone for de-escalation, conflict diffusion. When you send military equipment into your city streets, when you attempt to crack down on certain behaviors, you make the behaviors more intensive accidentally.
What about the division between armed and unarmed officers? How will that work?
We find that particularly minoritized communities are often avoiding calling the police because they don't want somebody to show up with a weapon and in uniform. But still, there's a need for a public safety response for so many things, from people having a mental health crisis to people who just need to file a report, say for a stolen bicycle. those folks should feel comfortable calling and getting a response, being able to file a report without an armed officer showing up. Now, how realistic is this? For this, we had to go to the data and ask, of all the things our officers are doing, what percentage of it never leads to an arrest? We found that not only is it a huge percentage of what the officers do, but that there are 7 call types that lead to about 35% of our officers' time that never result in an arrest. We know that before we even dispatch.
I'm thinking maybe domestic violence.
So domestics are complicated, and there we'll likely see a co-response, that is, armed officers showing up in collaboration with unarmed mental health specialists. But there are a bunch of things like welfare checks, for example. You know, people calling the police saying, I haven't seen my neighbor in a while. Could you go and make sure that they're okay? Noise complaints. So we know there's a huge opportunity here to replace an armed law enforcement response that more people will actually engage with and will free up our officers to do other duties.
There's been criticism. You know, many activists talk about painting the SWAT truck white. They say this is whitewashing, that, for instance, Ithaca Police Sergeant Kevin Slattery was suspended about bragging about using excessive force on a black suspect. He made comments about planting evidence. You know, they are pointing to that and saying, there's the reform that just painting a truck or taking someone with a gun out of a certain situation isn't going to change. It's a cultural thing.
For sure. And how do you change a culture? It involves accountability, obviously, right? And that's why the sergeant in question was suspended and demoted. But also, it's about the training. It's also about the recruitment. And it's about the tools that are available to our officers, both armed and unarmed, as they do their jobs. If you're going to change a culture, you can't expect any one change to do it all.
In the wake of George Floyd's death, we're learning that in the past year of pandemic and racial reckoning, that actually crime has increased in a lot of cities because guns have flowed more easily into cities, which is why police in many cities were doing more traffic stops, because it's one of the main ways to find guns. Do you worry that disarming some of your police might lead to some of those increases where you are as well in guns and crime?
Yeah, I don't so much. I mean, I'm worried about the cost of inaction. You know, our new system is designed to get people to cooperate with, collaborate with, and engage with the public safety infrastructure more frequently.
That's Mayor Savante Myrick of Ithaca, New York. We'll link it to their plans there to rebuild their police department. Mayor Myrick, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
You may not have noticed, but there's been a change to your local weather forecast. Starting this month, the data it's based on has been updated, making the warmer climate the new normal. NPR's Jennifer Ludden explains in this story that first aired on Morning Edition.
Weather forecasters work off a 30-year average, and it gets updated every decade. Until now, what's normal for temperature and precipitation was based on 1981 to 2010. That's why we've all gotten used to this.
Well, temperatures for your Friday will be running about 10 degrees warmer than normal.
Well, we got about 7 degrees above average yesterday.
Into tomorrow, above normal temperatures.
The past decade was one of the hottest on record. Mike Pilecki of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says that shows up in the new averages called climate normals. They dropped the 80s and wrapped in the 2010s.
It was a very substantial upward trend in temperature, especially along the West Coast and the South and along the East Coast.
Amber Sullins is chief meteorologist at ABC 15 in Phoenix, where she says last summer was incredibly hot.
We set a record of 53 days at 110 degrees or hotter. The previous record was 33 days, so it wasn't even close.
What's more, she says, in the entire past decade, Phoenix did not set a single record for low temperature. Now, oddly, after the update in May, some really hot days or nights could become officially cooler than the new normal. Sullins plans to take more time to explain all this.
We're going to have to remind people, especially this year, hey, if we're at 115, that is 5 degrees above the average. But remember, this average has changed. This average is not what it used to be.
That's important, says Bernadette Woods Plackey, chief meteorologist with the nonprofit Climate Central. She says research shows people are really good at simply resetting what feels normal, and she sees danger in that.
We're not aware of how much warming is happening on a regular basis. It's that slow grind that's eating away at the changing normal that doesn't give you the opportunity sometimes to sit back and look at what it used to be.
Marshall Shepard heads atmospheric sciences at the University of Georgia. He wonders if even using the term normal might be confusing, and he agrees that for most, the new weather averages will not impress.
1 degree warming doesn't sound like a lot to most people. In fact, many people say, oh, great, I could have cookouts in December more often.
But that steady warming has a big impact, which he says meteorologists can help people understand. It helps fuel increasingly extreme weather, wildfires, floods, hurricanes. Shepard says other impacts are more subtle, things like rising food prices, declining water supply, the spread of vector-borne disease.
It's about things happening right now that are affecting their kitchen table issues, their pocketbook, their livelihoods, and their health.
Industries feel this impact too, and for them, the official 30-year weather average is losing its relevance. NOAA's Mike Pilecki says businesses want more recent data that reflects the risks they face now. Energy companies need to predict extreme heat and cold, or take construction.
They like to know how many days does it rain during a certain period of time, so they have a certain number of rain days that they build into their plans.
So for the first time this year, NOAA also put out 15-year averages to help keep pace with a climate normal that just keeps changing. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
The White House said this week that President Biden will have a face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin next month. But so far, there doesn't seem to be any plan for the president to sit down with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Biden's predecessor met with Kim 3 times, and those efforts failed to change the equation on the Korean Peninsula. Let's check in on North Korea with Jean Lee. She's director of the Korea Center at the Wilson Center. And Jean, welcome back.
Hi, I'm happy to join you.
Glad you're here. Well, we wanted to speak to you when we read about this letter Kim wrote this week to labor organizations. And in this letter, he promises to fight anti-socialist elements inside of North Korea. What do you make of what he's saying in this letter?
It's so intriguing, isn't it? I think that Kim Jong-un is, what we're seeing is that he's seeking to regain control over the people, over what influences them, over what they covet. And what's so interesting about this letter is we have so little access right now. North Korea shut its borders, just sealed its borders in January 2020. There's been almost no traffic. We have very few foreign diplomats are there, no Western journalists. That also means a lack of trade going across the border like they had in recent years. And I imagine an antsiness, especially among the elites, for those foreign goods that they had developed a taste for while living overseas. And so really trying to address that unhappiness I suspect he is sensing or hearing about among his power base.
Well, what do you think he's referring to? What do you think he's referring to when he writes about anti-socialist and non-socialist practices?
Exactly. It's so interesting because I have seen, I spent quite a lot of time in North Korea during those early years of Kim Jong-un's leadership. He took power in December 2011, and he did want to see his people, or the elites, I should say, become more worldly. And so you did see a lot more traffic across the border, especially to China, a lot more goods coming in. But now he can't promise those goods anymore. And so it's been an interesting push and pull for him because while he wants to open up, he also risks losing control over the narrative, losing control over what they want. So it is kind of pushing back against that opening up that he had championed earlier in his leadership.
Right. You're saying that he's worried about holding on to power. He's admitted in recent months that he hasn't been able to improve the North's economic conditions. Are the pandemic and U.S. sanctions taking a toll? Is this a sign that it's taking a toll on North Korea?
It's hard to imagine that it isn't taking a toll. And he, while he's acknowledging that hardship, he is putting the blame directly on the United States and on the pandemic. I wouldn't say he's necessarily accepting the blame for the decisions he's making that are putting his people's lives in such a difficult situation. There's no doubt that the lack of goods going across the border both directions has had an impact. I do think that sanctions obviously have taken a bite, and so that is something that he will definitely have to keep in mind. I am concerned, however, that North Korea is ramping up its use of cyber as a way to get around the border closures, get around sanctions. That's something that we have to keep an eye on, because that would make it harder for the Biden administration to use sanctions as a way to try to force North Korea out of its isolation.
You're saying cybersecurity. And also, what is the status of the nuclear program right now?
Yes. So with cyber, I'm co-hosting a podcast for the BBC right now. It's called The Lazarus Heist, and it is just about North Korean cyber to try to help us understand what the stakes are for North Korea so that we can understand why their cyber capabilities are so strong. I mean, this is a country so cut off from the world, from the internet, and yet they are producing some of the world's best cyber attackers. And so I am looking at that issue because I do think that they are looking for ways to prop up the economy and continue building nuclear weapons. And we have to remember that though they've gone quiet, they are still working on that nuclear program. They are still working on ballistic missile technology, with the intent of coming back to negotiations with the United States eventually, but in a much stronger position. And that has very frightening implications, not only for the Korean Peninsula and Northeast Asia, but for all of us. And so we're trying to make that link between, the rise in cyber, where, how they're getting that money that they need, and where it's going.
Okay, with the 30 seconds I have with you, though, with all of what you're just saying here, will we see a Biden-Kim meeting anytime soon?
I don't think we're going to see one anytime soon, but I do hope that North Korea is looking at these signals and recognizes that they have the opportunity now with a leader who is committed to diplomacy and that they choose to come back to the international fold.
Jean Lee is director of the Korea Center at the Wilson Center. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.